this evening to Job chapter 20. Job chapter 20. In just a minute, we're going to resume our study at verse 1. Just to quickly set this up, Job has yet again expressed his frustration, not only over how his friends had continued to torment and crush him with their words, but also over the suffering that he was enduring at the hands of God. And yet, in spite of all his frustration, in spite of all of his angst concerning his current predicament, as we looked at in considerable depth last week, Job was still blessed beyond comprehension by the truth that his Redeemer lives. And remember, Job is expressing things that he should not have known, at least from a doctrinal theological perspective. The doctrine of the incarnation of Christ was still a great mystery, was not known at the time. Of course, he might have known, as we discussed, he might have known about Genesis 3:15, the proto-evangelium. That's highly doubtful, though. He certainly would not have known about the bodily resurrection of the dead, and yet he says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and I will see him on the earth. I will see him at last with my eyes and none other. And what did he say in response to this wonderful understanding? He said, my heart faints within me. And once again, I think we would all do well to take a note from that and look at our own future as God's elect and put it all in perspective in such a way that we too faint at the prospect of such wonderful blessings. Job challenges his friends at the end of the chapter, chapter 19 that is, with a bit of sobering reality. Remember, he said, how dare you go on persecuting me, saying it's his own fault. You should fear punishment yourselves, for your attitude deserves punishment. Then you'll know that there is indeed a judgment. In other words, Job wants his friends to understand that their constant accusations, accusations that are built really on nothing more than faulty assumptions, those things could very well end up being their own undoing. So what happened next? Did Job's friends finally see the light? Did they finally admit, yeah, Job, we've been unusually harsh on you. Please forgive us. We're going to try to be the comforters. We're going to try to be the best friends that you've ever had. No, they still don't see the light. They still haven't gotten the memo. And this is exemplified in what Zophar says, beginning at verse 1 of chapter 20. Here we read, then Zophar the Naamathite answered, therefore, my disquieting thoughts make me respond, even because of my inward agitation. I listen to the reproof which insults me, and the spirit of my understanding makes me answer. Do you know this from old, from the establishment of man on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short and the joy of the godless momentary? Now, I want you to stop right there for just a minute, because Zophar's response to everything that Job has just said is very telling. Notice that once again, instead of actually listening to what Job was saying and taking it to heart, instead of taking a moment to rejoice with Job's revelation that his Redeemer lives and he knows that he'll stand on the earth and that he will at last see him just as he is with his own eyes and not another. They should have at least been impressed, Job's friends, with the bombshell revelations concerning the incarnation, concerning the resurrection from the dead, the bodily resurrection from the dead. But if Zophar's response is any indication, we know that that wasn't the case. Zophar is still insisting that he's right, Job's wrong, and all Job needs to do is admit that he's wrong. All Job needs to do is admit that he is the sinner that they are making him out to be, and all will be well. Zophar says, basically, everything you've been saying about us is so inflammatory and so disheartening that I'm too agitated internally to withhold a response. In other words, Zophar's feelings have been hurt. Do you see the problem here? Whereas Job's friends should have felt compassion and pity for him, as he's requested from them a few times now, all they can think about is themselves. And remember, they're not sick. They haven't lost everything. They're not on the doorstep of death itself. They're not feeling betrayed by God himself. They are doing perfectly fine. And it's not surprising, but it's still sad that those who are doing well have a tendency to look down upon those who are not doing so well. And besides that, there is this very real tendency that we begin to ascribe motives for their not doing well, even though we absolutely know nothing about what's going on. Again, had they known that this was God's doing, had they known that instead of punishing Job for wrongdoing, all God was trying to do was show just how righteous he was, then their attitudes would have been much different. But they didn't even take time to consider those things. Instead, they lashed out on the basis of their hurt feelings. Well, all Zophar can think to say is, "What did you just say about me? How dare you?" And again, sadly, this is the way many react to even the gentlest rebuke. If Job's friends were genuine, if they truly cared about Job's well-being, if they truly loved him as they should have, they would have been able to see that Job's comments were spot on, and then they would have taken the necessary steps to correct themselves. The truth does hurt, doesn't it? Sometimes. Not always, but the truth does hurt. How prone are you to lash out when somebody tells you the truth, as opposed to really taking it in and trying to understand how you might be better as a result? Do you take it as a personal affront, or do you take it for what it sometimes is, and that's a friend's honesty trying to make you more like Christ? We need to be very careful that we're not so knee-jerky, that we don't just fly off the handle at the slightest insinuation that we might not be perfect. We can learn a lot on how not to behave from Job's friends here. As it was, Zophar chooses to remain both offended and disinterested in whether or not Job was actually speaking truth. This is why he even goes so far as to double down in his insistence that Job was, in fact, by all appearances, a wicked man who was simply being punished, as had always been the case throughout the history of mankind. This is why Zophar asks him, rather snarkily, I might add, in verses 4 and 5, "Do you not know this from, or do you know this from old, from the establishment of man on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short and the joy of the godless momentary?" In other words, Job, do you not realize that, as history has shown, the wicked don't last? God quickly uproots the wicked. God quickly dispenses of those who do evil in his sight. He continues in verse 6, saying about the wicked man in general, and no doubt about Job in particular. Zophar says, "Though his loftiness reaches the heavens and his head touches the clouds, he perishes forever like his refuse or his dung. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' He flies away like a dream and they cannot find him. Even like a vision of the night, he's chased away. The eye which saw him sees him no longer, and his place no longer beholds him." Now, in some cases, this is exactly right. There are men who, depending on the act of wickedness that they take part in, depending on the severity of that wickedness, there are those that God sees fit to uproot immediately, to deal with without delay. As I thought about this again, it made me think of Steve Lawson. God has seen fit, at least through the ministries that Steve Lawson was engaged in, was a part of. I don't know if you've been following this type of thing, but At this point, only less than, a month removed from the revelation of his wrongdoing, if you go online right now to any of the ministries he was associated with, it's as if he never existed. It's tragic. I'm not downplaying that. It's horrifically tragic in terms of the ripple effect that a single man's ministry can have on the church at large. No one would deny that, but I think Zophar's on to something. In some cases, God can take the one who is allegedly righteous and reduce that person to absolute anonymity in short order. This is what we're seeing in the case of so many, including Steve Lawson. His ministry and the success he once enjoyed, as Zophar says, those things seem to have flown away like a dream. The eye which saw him sees him no longer, and his place no longer beholds him. Zophar suggesting that the same kind of thing was happening to Job. According to Zophar, in the not-so-distant future, Job would be little more than a faint memory in the minds of those who once respected him, in the minds of those who revered him. He continues in verse 10, saying, his sons favor the poor, and his hands give back his wealth. This is really just a reference to one of those ripple effects. When great men fall due to wickedness, generally, it has a collateral effect on the man's family. And whereas Job's family was once held in high regard, now that it appears that he has fallen due to some unknown wickedness, his own sons, were they alive, would be forced to make friends with the poorest among them. Now, why would that be? Well, you know, when a man loses his favor, when he loses his position and the whole family falls, the tables are turned. The once rich are now among the poor. The ones who lorded their position over the poor are now begging the poor even for their scraps. This is what Zophar is saying is likely in Job's case. Let's continue reading at verse 11, and I'm just going to read on through this, and it really deserves no in-depth commentary. I will stop occasionally and make some commentary if necessary. But listen to what Zophar continues to say about the fate of the wicked man. And bear in mind again, Zophar is saying that this is just the way God operates. This is how God quickly dispenses with the wicked man. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it lies down with him in the dust. Though evil is sweet in his mouth and he hides it under his tongue, though he desires it and will not let it go, but holds it in his mouth, yet his food in his stomach is changed to the venom of cobras within him. He swallows riches, but will vomit them up. God will expel them from his belly. He sucks the poison of cobras. The viper's tongue slays him. He does not look at the streams, the rivers flowing with honey and curds. He returns what he has attained and cannot swallow it. As to the riches of his trading, he cannot even enjoy them. For he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has seized a house which he has not built. Because he knew no quiet within him, he does not retain anything he desires. Nothing remains for him to devour. Therefore, his prosperity does not endure. In the fullness of his plenty, he will be cramped. The hand of everyone who suffers will come against him. When he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him and will rain it on him while he is eating. He may flee from the iron weapon, but the bronze bow will pierce him. It is drawn forth and comes out of his back, even the glittering point from his gall. Terrors come upon him. Complete darkness is held in reserve for his treasures. An unfanned fire will devour him. It will consume the survivor in his tent. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart. His possessions will flow away in the day of his anger. That is God's anger. This is the wicked man's portion from God, even the heritage decreed to him by God. Needless to say, that's a pretty dire forecast for anyone who would seek to be among the evil, the wicked. It's as though Zophar has pulled out all the stops. At this point, he's stopping at nothing to make Job feel less than. He's making Job feel as though he's deserving of all these things. Job, do you not know? Have you not studied history sufficiently enough to know that this is just the way of the wicked? God will dispense of you in due time. So how does Job respond to this not so veiled assessment of his character by Zophar? Chapter 21. Then Job answered, "Listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your way of consolation, or better, this is one consolation that you can give me, is just to hear me out. Listen to me. Bear with me that I may speak. Then, after I've spoken, you may mock." Now stop there. Job has resigned himself to the fact that no matter what he says, no matter how convincing he tries to be, his friends are going to continue to mock everything that he says. He's resigned himself to the hatred of his friends. They are despised at him. They are no longer willing to listen to what he has to say in his own defense because none of it thus far has made any real sense to them. And oh, by the way, most of it sounds like a direct accusation against them. But he says, "Listen to me, indulge me for just a minute longer, and then you can continue mocking me." He says in verse 4, "As for me, is my complaint to man?" In other words, I'm complaining to God, not to you. Is my complaint against you? And, you know, I had to really stop and think about that. Thus far, very little of what Job has had to say is directed at his three friends. I mean, he's thrown the occasional barb at them. You guys are really lousy comforters. You guys are really not giving me the courtesy that I would hope to give you if you were in a similar circumstance as I. But aside from that, he's not really said anything against them. He's done more in his complaints to God himself than he has in complaining about his friends. And this is Job's whole point. I'm complaining to God, not to man. And since that's the case, he says, why should I not be impatient? Now think about that. Of all the people in the world, in the universe, that could possibly help Job in his current situation, the only prospect for help is God himself. And Job says, I've cried to him day and night, and my help doesn't seem to be coming. Why should I not be impatient? I've done everything I know to do, and God is still apparently ignoring my plight. See, remember, Job doesn't know why he's suffering either. This wouldn't come until much later when he realizes, you know, as God explains to him why he had to go through all this, but Job's still locked in mystery himself. And in Job's estimation, you know, Job was a righteous man, a man of prayer, a man of possessing a deep relationship with God. And in the past, every time he cried out to God, apparently God answered him. God rewarded him by virtue of his faithfulness and so on and so forth. Job's complaints to God, according to him, gave him license to just not be as patient as they might expect him to be. A better translation, again, the word impatient here is not really the most accurate word. The better word here would be troubled, right? When we talk about impatience, we're talking about, you know, God making certain, or Job making certain demands on God. You know, God, I've waited this long. I don't think I can wait any longer, that sort of thing. But if you insert the word troubled there, it makes much more sense. A better translation would have Job asking, why shouldn't I be troubled when it seems as if God Himself is not answering my pleas for mercy. In other words, Job is basically wanting his friends to understand that up to this point, he hasn't said anything that would have warranted the kind of response he's received from them. He's not been attacking them. They're the ones that have made these wild accusations based on mere assumption and speculation that he must be in sin of some kind, and an especially egregious sin at that. Job's not retorted similarly. Job, if you go back and read everything that he said to his friends directly, everything has been instructive. Everything has been really spot on concerning the wisdom that he possessed. He continues in verse 5 saying, "Look at me and be astonished and put your hand over your mouth." Well, what does that mean? Well, it means exactly what it sounds like. If you were to see Job as he was at this very moment, you would have seen a man who has probably aged 30 years within the span of 30 days. You would have seen a man who's emaciated, if not still plagued with boils from head to toe, at least the after effect of those boils. He's got ashes all over him. He's filthy dirty. He's probably not sleeping. He would have been truly a sight for sore eyes. Looking at Job would have automatically caused one to put their hand over their mouth. Oh my. Here's a very telling thing. It's quite obvious that they hadn't even taken the time to actually see him. You understand? They cared more about their own feelings than they did about his plight. And that's a shame. He's saying, "Hear me now, just give me a moment to speak. Look at me and be astonished and put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I'm disturbed and horror takes hold of my flesh. Why do the wicked still live? Continue on, also become very powerful. Their descendants are established with them in their sight and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear and the rod of God is not on them. His ox mates without fail, his cow calves, and does not abort. They send forth their little ones like the flock, and their children skip about. They sing to the timbrel and harp and rejoice at the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity, and suddenly they go down to Sheol. They say to God, 'Depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreat him?'" Job is actually hitting on something here that dismantles Zophar's complete premise. Does the wicked man, in fact, meet an undesirable immediate end? No. No. Job's saying, look, that part of what you said is not even true. Now, they will eventually meet their end. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay." They will pay for every sin that they have committed without being covered with the blood of Jesus Christ. They will stand before the Lord naked. They'll stand before him fully responsible and fully aware that they're deserving of nothing but hell on that great day. But that doesn't mean that they experience that immediately in this life. Many of them live to a ripe old age without suffering any of God's displeasure. Have you ever noticed that about the wicked? You know, I don't mean this in an insensitive way, and I certainly pray for his salvation, but when is George Soros going to die? Right? The wicked seem not just to have incredible influence over our society, but it goes on and on and on and on. So what Zophar says about, you know, the wicked, they come to an immediate end. God immediately plucks them up. No, it's not true. And remember, Zophar's like, do you not understand from your understanding of history that God always operates this way? And Job's saying he doesn't. He doesn't always operate this way. Listen to Samuel Driver's commentary here because it's really helpful. He says, the facts are not as Zophar represents. On the contrary, the wicked actually live even to old age, enjoying all manner of prosperity. Why? For they are even openly defiant to God. No doubt it sometimes happens that calamity befalls the wicked, but how often? Perhaps, too, God punishes the children of the wicked after the fathers are dead, but that does not affect the wicked themselves. For once life is over, one who has enjoyed prosperity up to the end is no worse off than the one who has lived miserably. A difference of fortune belongs to life only. The dead all share a common fate. Not only are the friends wrong as to the facts, but also wrong in their inference that because Job's house has been destroyed, Job is wicked. It is in those that escape calamity that wickedness might be more safely suspected. But men are afraid to accuse powerful sinners, however patient or however patent their sins. They rather cringe before them in their lifetime and honor them in death. The emphasis in this speech lies not on Job's suffering in spite of his righteousness, but on the appalling fact that men prosper in spite of being wicked. An appalling fact, since it seems to reflect on God. This is exactly what Job's saying. The wicked seem to prosper. And not only that, they last a long time in a great many cases. But there will be a day of reckoning, a day on which they will give an account for the wickedness that they have committed. And they will suffer the eternal wrath of God as a consequence. Job knows that. He knows that. He goes on to say in verse 16, "Behold, their prosperity is not in their hand. The counsel of the wicked is far from me." Now, this verse can be a little bit difficult to understand. But most scholars feel as though Job is saying, look, whatever prosperity the wicked enjoys, it's not from their own hands, but from the very hand of God. From the very hand of the God that they reject. Right? This, in turn, simply validates their wickedness. Job says, As for me, far be it from me to live according to their way of life. Job's distancing himself from the wicked. He's saying they receive what they receive from the hand of God. I've received what I've received from the hand of God, whether it be good or ill. But I'm not like them. This is Job's final statement on the matter, at least in this context. In verse 17, he carries his argument further, saying, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or does their calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger? Are they as straw before the wind and like chaff, which the storm carries away? And again, Job's meaning seems to be that although calamity does occasionally befall the wicked, although they are sometimes sent to an early grave, that's not always the case. In fact, God's punishment of the wicked seems to be the exception as opposed to the rule, at least in the way Job understood things to be. In verses 19 through 21, Job says to his friends, you say God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons. And that's true enough. The sins of the father are revisited on the second and third generations in a manner of speaking. That is, the ripple effect of the sins committed will have some sort of impact on subsequent generations. We know that. But Job's friends were saying that God stores away a man's iniquity for his sons. Listen to what he says. Let God repay him, the wicked man, so that he may know it. Let his own eyes see his decay, and let him drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what does he care for his household after him, when the number of his months is cut off? And this is another way of Job separating himself from the wicked man. Job's like, look, I mean, if God is just going to take the wicked out of this world and leave the destruction to befall his sons, that doesn't make any sense. Let God show the wicked man the power of his might. Let God show the wicked man the error of his ways. Let the wicked man himself suffer these things. In fact, if you'll notice what's gone on in Job's life, you'll see that he can't be equated with the wicked men in Zophar's eyes, because where are Job's own sons? They're dead. They're dead. Now, I suppose Zophar and company could have made the claim that, well, they're only dead because of your wickedness. But that is not in line with what they're maintaining. They're maintaining that God takes the wicked out of the world and then reserves judgment for the wickedness for the sons. You see, they're wrong not only historically, but theologically as well. And Job's wanting to point this out. Above all, Job is trying to separate himself from the category of the wicked. Think about this very carefully. And again, it doesn't take a whole lot of brain power, but if, as Job's friend Zophar has just suggested, God does bring swift destruction on the wicked, then why is it that more often than not, it's the wicked man's children who are left to pay for his wickedness? This is the question he wants Zophar to answer. He's like, you don't have an answer for this because what you've said is wrong and what I'm saying is exactly right. Job asks rhetorically in verse 22, can anyone teach God knowledge in that he judges those on high? In other words, Zophar, God doesn't need you to instruct him or remind him on how he deals with the wicked. You're not his teacher. And oh, by the way, you don't need to be saying these things to me. I know perfectly well how God deals with the wicked. I think, it's a very telling moment here. God doesn't need to be taught how to deal with the wicked. He judges even the most powerful of beings. I mean, what are we? This kind of makes you think what David prayed, Lord, who is man that you're mindful of him? You know, it brings more light to the fact that the angels marvel over our salvation. I suspect that that's because they look at us and they look at God and they're like, why? Why bother? And they know how righteous God is because a third of them have been judged and cast out of heaven, awaiting a future judgment where they'll be thrown into the lake of fire forever. Job's like, who are we? Who are we both to escape the judgment of God, any of us, and who are we to teach God how he should respond to the wicked man, which is what he assumed Zophar was attempting to do. As for the fate of man, Job goes on to suggest that it's completely up to God how and when any man dies. Verses 23 through 26. One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied. His sides are filled out with fat, and the marrow of his bones is moist, while another dies with a bitter soul, never even tasting anything good. Together they lie down in the dust, and worms cover them. It's an important lesson for us all. The rich man and the poor man will experience the same day of judgment. Once we die, the playing field is level. There are no rich, there are no poor, there are no famous, there are none who are not famous, there are none who get the accolades anymore from their fellow men. They're dead. The playing field is level. And this is Job's point. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really even matter, Zophar, if you think I'm the wicked man in this case. I'm still here. But should God decide to remove me, he's just as apt to remove the guy down the street who's seemingly done nothing to deserve that. This is another nod, I believe, to God's sovereignty over all things. Job understands it. Do his friends understand it? I don't think so. God is not, as Zophar suggested, duty-bound to follow a precise pattern relative to the wicked man's death as opposed to any other man's death. This is the mistake that Zophar has made. In doing this, Zophar's painting God as being a respecter of persons, or maybe a disrespecter of persons. Either way, he's making the point that God singles out certain men. Let me just ask you this. Outside of Christ, what are all of us deserving of? wrath, hell. Well, wait a minute. Does that mean I can be the greatest philanthropist the earth has ever seen? And I'm going to receive the same death that the laziest bum who's ever lived receives? Yes. Yes. God is no respecter of persons in that regard. Job says to Zophar, we're all the same. We're all the same. The way that Job was seemingly being taken out of this world had nothing to do with whether he was wicked or not. That's the point. Even if you're right, Zophar, it has no bearing on my present condition. Job was simply leaving this earth the way that God had sovereignly decreed. And he decrees the same fate for men of far less stature and of far greater stature. He has numbered our days, and when those days run out, poof, we're gone. That's Job's point. You have to imagine that Job's friends, including Zophar, thought themselves to be above him, superior to him. Well, at least we're not suffering because, you know, I mean, if you're going to accuse me of being wicked and that's why I'm suffering, then what are you saying about yourself when you're not suffering? I'm not as wicked as you. And again, Job wants them to understand we're all in the same boat. At least I have had the revelation that my Redeemer lives. You know, as I was reading this, I was waiting for Job to say that. Zophar, what about your Redeemer? Do you know your Redeemer lives? He never asks it, but you got to wonder, right, where Zophar's mind is. Well, Lord willing, we're going to pick up next time at verse 27. Job has some final words for his friends on this particular issue, only to be confronted yet again by Eliphaz in chapter 22. It's really a fascinating insight into human behavior. Why they don't just relent, especially seeing Job for what he was at the moment. It just boggles the mind that man can be so hard-hearted and so judgmental when it comes to such things. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Do you think Eliphaz is going to come forth in sackcloth and ashes and say, "Oh, Job, we're so sorry. On behalf of myself and your other two friends, we're so sorry." No. No. This really won't happen at all until the Lord himself intervenes, comes out of the whirlwind and says, "Who is this who darkens counsel with words without knowledge? Gird up your loins and y'all listen to me." It's going to be a great time when we get there, right?